If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe. And this week we are going to find out what it is like to live the life of the lycra-clad Knight of the Road. How does London look to one of the city's cycle couriers?
Hey baby, let me take you down. So we'll play some strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the light before. Just a song through from your front door.
Well, hello, hello from atop a grassy knoll, just around the corner from Highbury and Islington Station. We're in the shade of some trees, on a little green, on a grassy knoll, if you will. It's a fierce day. By the time this goes to broadcast, we'll probably be in monsoon season, so this will seem extremely out of place. Nostalgia, yes. With me is John Day, and an enormous bicycle. Hello, John.
Hi.
This thing that you've brought along today, I mean, this is no ordinary bike, but it gives us a bit of a route in, perhaps, to what we're going to be talking about, part of your life. This is twice the length of a normal bike. Think tandem length, and it's just come from Heathrow. Could you give us a description?
I can. It's a Bullet cargo bike that I bought last week to sort of celebrate, nothing really. I suppose not being a bicycle courier anymore. It's the kind of bike that you see people cycling around London with, carrying huge boxes full of legal papers or sofas or ovens.
Sofas?
Yeah, you can get, I think, up to 180 kilos on it, so it can it can pretty much deal with anything a small car would.
Yeah, I've been trying to work out what this is, because, listener, you'll know the bike with the attachment on the back. If you want your child to be instantly crushed by whatever vehicle fails to stop in time behind you, you can get those ones. But this is much more, I think there's a Dutch style of bike, isn't there, with a great big scoop front.
This is basically modelled on those Dutch buck fietsers, which are slightly more sit up and beg versions. This is
much more Buck Rogers.
A bit, I like to think so. Yeah, it's solid and fast and great fun to ride, and also people get out of the way when you're riding it in a way that they don't always when you're riding a thick gear or a road bike, something like that.
That's interesting. I was thinking about how much the front part of it, because it looks sort of armchairy. How much?
Can I have a go?
Yeah, I will. Okay, in a minute. I don't think that's going to make for good audio, but I'm definitely going to have a go.
Maybe we should have recorded it in the cycling around.
Well, no, because then I'd be up the front end and looking into the exhaust pipe of it. No, I don't fancy that at all. In fact, that's a bit of an issue, isn't it?
It hasn't been yet, but then my daughter's too young to complain, possibly. So yeah, she'll.
Right, when she has a 40-day smoking habit by the age of 5, you'll know it's all right. But it reminds me a lot of those lying down bikes. It looks like a collision has occurred between a lying down bike and a normal bike.
Yeah, it does, now you come to mention it.
Anyway, enough of that. But you've bought a bike to celebrate not having to ride a bike anymore.
Not having to ride a bike professionally anymore, yeah.
So, and this experience of, 4 years, I think, has formed the basis of a beautiful piece of writing. A very serious, not an amusing piece of writing.
Yeah, I'd like to think it's at least entertaining. But yeah, I was a bicycle messenger or courier for 3 or 4 years over a kind of 10-year period in between doing other things, studying for various degrees and discovering that I didn't want to have an office job. So and I wrote a book that was published last year about that experience called Cyclogeography. And yeah, it's partly a kind of a memoir of my time as a courier in London, and a kind of portrait of the city seen from the saddle, but it's also, as the terrible but unavoidable punning title suggests, an engagement with a tradition of, in particular, London writing that comes under the broad umbrella term of psychogeographical, which I'm sure many of your listeners will have come across before. But I kind of discovered this subgenre, if not subculture, of writing while I was a courier. So I began reading. The term goes back to Guy Debord and the Situationist International and these kind of radically politically engaged sociologists in mid-century France and Paris in particular, who set out a kind of research, a playful research program, which they termed psychogeography, which was to be the study of the relationship between the individual psyche and the urban environment. And Guy Debord in particular, who was the kind of the most prominent an aggressive proponent of the idea, came up with all sorts of kind of psychogeographic games that he suggested would allow us to kind of rediscover the urban environment that we all lived in by denaturing it, by making it strange in various ways. And the kind of central principle of the psychogeographic game was the derive, the drift, where you would kind of enforce various paradigmatic or you know, programmatic rather, rules on your on a journey through the city, usually a walk. So you might do something like draw a shape on a map and then walk the shape that you've drawn and record the experiences you have as you go. Or in a kind of famous pointless game, they once, I think, used a map of Berlin to try and navigate Paris. So it was all about kind of breaking free from a world of signs that the city so often is. And this tradition of writing was kind of rediscovered and promoted by, in particular, people like Ian Sinclair and Will Self in the 90s and early 2000s as a kind of way of essentially kind of structuring a walk, a piece of travel writing, as far as I can tell. So it's kind of lost its political edge to some degree in its second wave manifestation, I would argue.
But all the same, it sounds as though socially or culturally it would still be about transgression of some sort.
I think it is, yeah. I mean, often the transgression is kind of sanctioned by we've talked a bit about kind of nostalgia for London, and I think one charge you might make of the kind of second wave psychogeographers is they do tend to kind of fetishize either a declining industrial infrastructure or a kind of loss, you know, the romanticization of certain kinds of spaces in London, like Sinclair trudging around the Olympic Park and so on, has been, the sociologist James Hartsfield calls it London nostalgia, this idea that we're kind of resistant to things like redevelopment and gentrification and so on because they allow lone white males to wander in raptures kind of these old industrial sites. So I think I don't agree with that critique necessarily, but I think there's a sense in which the kind of radicalism of Deborian psychogeography was slightly lost sight of in its second wave incarnation.
Because that seems extremely important and very much so to in relation to what I do. The danger there seems to be losing a sort of authenticity, not being able to strike it in the first place.
I mean, the question of whether authenticity has ever existed, I suppose, in this kind of writing, is that's always the charge, isn't it? And it's something I think that all of these writers, myself included, are, I suppose, made anxious by. Coming back to how this relates to couriering, or at least cycling in London, partly the psychogeographic tradition is riffing on an idea that walking enables you to, is a kind of democratic mode of encountering any kind of landscape, and it's one that is both a little bit subversive potentially, because you're either kind of walking in places that you're not supposed to be, or allows you to get off kind of officially sanctioned channels of movement. So for Debord and so on, the idea that you didn't have to get on a particular bus or a tram line or whatever, that you could kind of make your own way through a city was kind of exciting.
Knocking on the door of romanticism, actually.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's the, in a sense, I'm sure, I mean, all of these ideas do, including the political radicalism, of course, because for Wordsworth and Coleridge, the walk was a kind of radical democratic act and something that was kind of taken on by people who kind of, you know, trespassed on Kinder Scout or whatever. There are kind of literal radical manifestations of the walk as an act of dissent. And of course, romanticism at least thought of itself as being a democratic form. About in the preface of the Lyrical Ballads, Wordsworth talks about a poetry that for the first time is written in the language of the common man. And so the whole shtick of romanticism was certainly founded on that notion of accessibility and openness, I suppose. But what struck me when reading these writers is that, with a few notable exceptions, no one really had written about the relationship between the bicycle ride and urban space in particular, or landscape in general. There are a few, and I go into them in the book. I think there's a kind of strong Irish literary tradition which treats the bike as a kind of slightly strange and subversive vehicle. I'm thinking in particular of the work of Flann O'Brien and Samuel Beckett, where the bike becomes this kind of sinister force. And in the French tradition, in the work of Alfred Jarry, who is this kind of early 20th century playwright and pataphysician, a bit of a forerunner actually of the Situationists. And he wrote a book called The Super Male, which is a kind of long short story about a race between a group of professional cyclists and a steam train, and it kind of becomes kind of absurd. It's really a satire on hyper masculinity and the way in which the Tour de France and the Grand Tours of the early 20th century were turning bodies into machines, essentially. So in this race, the cyclist, one of the cyclists, dies and is forced to carry on racing because he's contracted to, so his body just lies there twitching and finishing the race, and they're all kind of doped up on strychnine and all sorts of, so partly I you know, this relationship between bodies and machines that the bicycle represents, that can either be a kind of a futurist orientated kind of vision of dystopian subjugation of the body, or can be a kind of nostalgic, I'm thinking in terms of, who was it who said, whose vision of Englishness was old maids riding bikes to churches, you know, it was
John Major,
wasn't it? Yeah, and of course, you know, the on your bikeism of Norman Tebbit, there's this idea that the bike represents kind of individual exceptionalism and self-propelled effort, really, in a conservative nostalgic mould. So all of these kind of ideas were obviously running through my head. I mean, one of the great advantages...
He does think a lot for a cycle courier, doesn't he?
You have a lot of time to think as a cycle courier. I think that's the key. So, you know, when you only get paid for the packages that you know, deliver, and on the downtime you're sitting around, sometimes on nice days like today, often in the rain, on a bench. And so I use those moments, you know. I read, basically, in those moments. And so the book was kind of a product both of my experiences cycling around London, but also the reading I did in my downtime in that, and I wrote a lot of it on those same park benches.
Did your academic other life have much to do in any obvious way with the cycling?
Well, I mean, no, weirdly not. I mean, I suppose my research interests as an academic are in the same period. I sort of work on modernist literature, broadly conceived, but the authors I wrote about in this book and the ideas don't really... There's not much crossover, no.
I met one, I knew him very well, a cycle courier. He was very much his job. He enjoyed it very much. He was all about cycling, all about being on the road. The overwhelming issues that seemed to come through from him were to do with getting things around on time and avoiding death. And I presume that must be something that you find yourself having to address when talking about the work.
Yeah, that's true.
The avoiding death stuff.
The avoiding death stuff. I mean, it's a physically demanding and potentially dangerous job. And indeed, those were some of the things that I think most attracted me to it, in the sense that it's actually pretty hard to finish a day's work in the contemporary world, or in the West, in an urban environment that knackers you. You know, I think very few people do the kind of physical labour. Like every day, I suppose an average day you cycle about 60 to 100 miles, and by the end of a week, I really felt kind of really blissfully exhausted, and I loved that. I loved feeling tired at the end of the day and not having to, you know, and switching off. And I've never slept better than I have when I was couriering. And you know, you mentioned danger, and I suppose, I mean, I'd sort of always cycled in London. I grew up here, and I grew up cycling here, so I don't feel uncomfortable in traffic. And as a courier, you get such confidence in your own, in what you're doing, in the microscopic movement of cycling quickly through traffic, that you, touch wood, have quite a lot of confidence in your own, you know, bike handling skills, I suppose. So I never had any particularly bad accidents, although plenty of scrapes. And yeah, I suppose the single-mindedness you're talking about that your friend had is definitely there. You have to do this job, which is quite badly paid and, as I've said, physically demanding. You have to love cycling, really. There's no point doing it otherwise. And you have to discover... You have to love discovering the city, because even though I'd lived here my whole life, I felt that that's really the great kind of breakthrough for me, was realising that London was both vast and knowable, and that I wanted to know it. I wanted to kind of master a version of that fabled thing, the cabbie's knowledge. So yeah, I kind of love that discovery. You have this weird relationship, you develop this weird relationship also with the buildings of the city as a courier, because you're often sent to post rooms, especially in big commercial developments. A lot of the work you do is you know, place like Moore London Place or wherever it might be. You get kind of privileged access, or it feels like privileged access, to this kind of backstage city that no one else really knows about. And that was pretty compelling too.
Can we develop that idea a little bit?
Well, I'm just thinking of the kind of people always ask me, like, you know, what weird jobs do you do? And in the book, I describe a few of them. One was, some of them are just kind of obvious and I guess too irresistible not to write about. So I delivered tea bags to Buckingham Palace once that I picked up from Fordham Masons, and I used to deliver quite regularly packages to number 10 Downing Street, and you just kind of get way through the front. Weirdly, they don't have a post room, so when you're delivering something to David Cameron, as was, you kind of way through to knock on the front door, and I like that feeling that you never knew quite where you'd end up during a day's work.
But there was something else I think I read in your gaze just then, before you went out the well-rehearsed anecdotes. I think I saw something else there, some sort of fondness for something.
Something that's a bit less hard to describe, I suppose, and it sounds ridiculous, but things like the idiosyncrasies of particular lifts, goods lifts in London. I remember Greater London House, which is this kind of, I'm sure many of your listeners will know it, just near Mornington Crescent, a big kind of Art Deco-y Egyptian-clad building, which has the most kind of, infuriating lift, actually, in many ways. But there's something about it and the graffiti within it that I was sent to kind of every week or so that I grew quite fond of. That and the kind of the vast infrastructure underground at places like More London, which are, you know, they're essentially just giant loading bays, but they feel like kind of miniature villages or, you know, nation states. In some of these places, they take your photo, they'll give you a temporary ID, and then you're kind of released into this other world. And it's a world that I don't think many people have.
So this is the exact opposite to being a tourist, but it's on that same spectrum.
Yes, I suppose it is. And in a sense, it takes us back to that question of psychogeography as a means of discovering an unknown city, either by losing yourself in a place you don't... You know, Walter Benjamin famously said that to lose oneself in a city as one loses oneself in the countryside is almost impossible, because a city is built of signs. You have to kind of willfully ignore the fact that you can look at a map, that everything's artificial, essentially, you know, planned and designed and organised. And I suppose this, in a sense, my experience as a courier gave the lie to that, in the sense that though you can read a city, you can't always access everything about it. And that freedom of access that I got was something I kind of shamelessly exploited, in that there's some writers like Ian Sinclair. I interviewed him for the book and in the book, and he was very, you know, he's a wonderfully accommodating man, and I just kind of turned up on his doorstep with a letter one day, dressed as a courier, and so the kind of uniform of the job gives you this strange access to people. Think it's a bit weird that there's this courier who's interested in talking to you, and so him and Richard Long, who's an artist who I also spoke to for the book and recreated one of his cycling sculptures, those were both relationships I developed through the kind of weirdness of being a courier and turning up on someone's doorstep and going, hello, I've got a letter for you.
Well, there's the access, and there's also, I'm seeing how one would tie together the quote you mentioned from Benjamin, Guy Debord and his artificial impositions on how you navigate. I think what I see in common between you and the chap I mentioned earlier was there was a great pleasure to be had from being one removed from all the rules. You know, having a freedom to move around in a way that other people did, not just about access, but about liberation in some way.
Yeah, and that's there's a great paradox at the heart of that, of course, in that it's a bad, unregulated job. You're paid often less than minimum wage. So the freedoms that I agree are certainly there in your day-to-day work. You know, the idea that you're kind of separate from the other city users and I suppose, in a sense, superior in how you navigate a city or move around it. That was incredibly intoxicating, but also completely chimerical and misleading in the sense that, yeah, it's very badly regulated. You're self-employed, so if you get knocked off, there's no sick pay. You're only paid for the work you do.
Is that an if or a when?
For me, it was a when, but there are people who claim never to have not. I think you'd be hard pushed to find a courier who's worked more than a few years who hasn't had some sort of scrape. But it creates this incredibly strong subcultural sense of community, and there's a kind of ersatz kind of union, I suppose, that was set up a few years ago called the London Courier Emergency Fund, which is a self-funded, it's not even an insurance, it just pays out to people who get knocked off on the job, and it's the only thing, it was for years the only thing that sort of protected people when they were injured. And amazingly, you know, there's some brilliantly energetic people who founded it and run it still, and it's completely funded by couriers mainly through kind of alley cat races or people, you know, donating money to the cause. In the last 6 months or so, there's been a strong move to unionise the courier industry through the work of the International Workers Union of Great Britain, who had quite a lot of success a few years ago campaigning on behalf of cleaners at London universities like SOAS and UCL, I think. And they've done great work arguing that the piecework that we've been paid, you know, rates have stayed the same essentially for about 20 years, or had done until they got involved, and they've targeted some of the biggest courier companies and got concessions that meant that couriers get paid quite a lot more now in those companies than they did before. And there's also a big push, as you may have noticed or seen, to do the same for the kind of unregulated food delivery businesses that are now springing up, like Uber Eats and Deliveroo, I suppose would be the big one. There's been a big prominent campaign against those in the last few weeks, which I think is, you know, really all to the good. It's a strange thing because in a sense the couriering industry has preempted what is now the hot thing in kind of decentralized startup employment labor companies. Things like, you know, thinking of those, what's the term for those, you know, delivery type organizations where you don't really have employees. Uber is the big one, so it's kind of messing with an established employment paradigm, and I think to the detriment actually of workers, the people who are really screwed in these new scenarios, these new working conditions, and not the startups, but they are the people who have to do the labour on the ground at the end of the day.
Yeah, quite so. I mean, there was that interesting case at Byron Burger not long ago, wasn't there? It was interesting because when you dig into that, you realise that the company is under pressure of huge financial fines to police the paperwork, but actually they don't have the equipment or the resources or the databases to be able to do that.
I don't know whether Byron Burgers can be excused from that behaviour by suggesting that too much pressure is put on them to monitor their own staff. I think if that is the case, then the answer is to change the law, not to.
I strongly agree with you there. Yeah,
yeah, but I think it's slightly different when you have.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Kind of energetic, often hugely financed startups like Uber. Uber's had $500 million worth of investment over the course of its young life, and it's not making a profit. But what it can do is kind of instigate this hyper race to the bottom by sucking up all of the kind of, I mean, life as a minicab and a minicab driver in a traditional minicab office probably wasn't great either, but I'm sure
life of luxury, I should imagine.
Darn sight better than working, I think, for what Uber might become if all of those little companies go under, because they've pumped $500 million worth of investment into essentially buying workers' rights. It seems to me it's a kind of nefarious position you're in if you're employed as a self-employed subcontractor, which Uber drivers and all couriers are, because you basically are an employee. You have to turn up, you have to do your 9 to 5, you often have to pay to rent equipment or a radio or a uniform or whatever, and yet you're afforded none of the...
Oh, you're uniformed as well then?
Well, some courier companies are. I didn't work for any of those that were or that charged you for that, but you usually have to pay a kind of charge to rent a radio and a XTA, the device that you get jobs on. And that just seems to me a way of smuggling in Victorian working conditions into the modern, seemingly forward-looking economy, and it's a dangerous thing. And I think people like the IWGB and other kind of younger networked unions will do good to combat, actually, because I think it would be a dangerous and terrible thing if this became the norm of employment, which it seems increasingly it is. You know, 0-hour contracts are part of the same tendency, I think.
There's another dimension to it as well, and this is purely on an emotional rather than any sort of intellectual or political basis, but watching the average Deliveroo driver pass you by with the enormous cube strapped to their back, there's no dignity in that at all.
No, and they're not. I mean, they look. I'm sort of shocked. I sort of first noticed them about a year ago, and they're just kind of normal cyclists. They haven't, unlike couriers, who've had about 20 years, I suppose, to develop a subculture, including what they look like, you know, and the kind of the way they ride and the kind of the competence. You know, lots of the things that you think of as cliches of courier fashion, if not subculture, do have slightly practical justification. So things like riding a fixed gear bicycle, it makes much more sense to ride a single speed with no gears to get mucky and dirty and break for if you're riding in dirty London streets every day. And I guess things like, you know, wearing lycra under your torn jeans. I'm not sure whether sort of the tattoos and facial piercings that you might also associate with couriers are necessarily part of a practical response to the working conditions. But
no, but it says subculture, subculture in the same way, doesn't
and
it?
Delivery riders just haven't developed that at all. They are, you know, they're just people who need to work. Who have a bike and think, well, I'll give this a go. And in a sense, that makes it even worse, I think, the way in which, you know, they don't really know what they're signing up to, I think.
Is unionisation the way forward, and specifically in the political, not just the political climate, but with a big black hole, as I perceive it, at the top of the Labour Party, against a strong Conservative movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think the questions of what it means to be an employee for a company, for one of the, you know, for a courier company or any of these other places that kind of smuggle in, that fudge the issue of self-employment, it hasn't really got a great deal to do with the meta politics of Labour or Tory rule. There are practical solutions to very acute problems, and people like the IWGB seem to be being very effective at solving those problems. You know, they are showing that being disruptive, that protesting, that getting on the streets and showing that actually these companies all depend on their workers at the end of the day, just as unions have traditionally always done, is an effective strategy at getting workers' rights back. And I think so, irrespective of the question of whether, you know, big unions should have any say in our kind of national political conversation, it's clear that the tactics of unionisation are as essential and important to the rights of workers as they always have been.
Although presumably you don't need too many people, too great a proportion of the available workforce not to be unionised for that not to work. And something that strikes me with this job beyond all others is that this is a large number of very individuals going about their business. Surely other people are going to step in.
It's true, and that's what makes, I think, what they've done so impressive, actually, because traditionally it's been incredibly hard to unionise the courier workforce. There have been various attempts over the past 20 years to do so, and they've all failed, partly because there's a huge turnover of workers often who are doing this kind of work, but also, yeah, as you say, there's a kind of resistance to collective action, I think, in some respects, to what has been in the past. What's kind of impressive, I think, about what the Deliveroo protests achieve is that actually there is no union. This was a wildcat strike, because they weren't even actually employees. That was the whole point. It was kind of facilitated by people with organising experience, but it was the workers themselves saying, no, we're not going to. What was happening was that the Deliveroo decided to impose a new contract on their riders that would do away with their hourly rate and pay them as piece workers instead. They claimed it was a trial and so on, and the workers just made them very quickly realise that those are the people, you know, you can't deliver any overpriced takeaways when your workers are unwilling to do that for you. So that's what it's shown, you know, and I don't really know why it's happened as it has. Maybe it's just become more conspicuous, or maybe I think the truth is that back in the day you could earn quite good money as a bicycle messenger. You know, there's stories of in the 80s and 90s and the first wave of couriering, people used to earn, well, they earned roughly what they earn today, I suppose. So a good week you'd earn 500 quid, but back in the 80s and 90s that would be a pretty good salary, whereas now it's not enough to live on, or barely. And there are obvious reasons for why that decline has occurred, some of which are kind of technological. The old story of the fax machine taking a chunk of the work out of couriers' bags, and then the internet obviously made another dent in it. So there's definitely been a decline in the numbers of traditional bicycle couriers in London. But people will always need goods delivered. And there's also a kind of another funny parrot on a law, I suppose, of information technology that...
Accidentally say parrot just then?
No, paradigm, I think.
Oh, paradigm.
But then I realised that was both pretentious and wrong. But there's this kind of law. So a lot of the work I ended up doing in my final year on the road was for media companies, where I was carrying, for film companies in particular, hard drives with rushes on. And it's still the case that it's quicker and cheaper, indeed, to send a courier with a large data dump than it is to email a big file, because a hard drive will always, or has so far, always increase its capacity above that of the bandwidth of the internet. So it's a very strange, almost kind of Moore's Lawrian thing, where it will always be quicker over short distances to send a courier with a bike with a, you know, computer on it than to email something. And I quite like that way in which the human component of information transfer manifests itself still at the level of, you know, big files anyway. You know, for hundreds of thousands of years, the fastest speed information could travel was really the speed of a human being or an animal, or potentially, I suppose, if you take into account smoke signals, the speed of light, but it couldn't travel very far. You know, pigeons are the obvious kind of analogue to the first wave of that kind of technology. But yeah, it's only very recently that I think that's been disrupted.
Disrupted, but not quite transcended.
Still not quite transcended, yeah. Depending on what you're sending, how much information you're sending, I suppose, yeah.
So who else do you consider to be part of the world of the cycle courier?
I suppose, you know, there's quite a lot of solidarity between motorbike couriers and bike couriers, partly because you're both on two wheels and feel the same vulnerabilities. But, you know, there's a lot more, I felt a lot more connected with those kinds of road users than I do now. Now, you know, cyclists are such a often irritatingly celebratory group of people that I'm you know, I'm part of that crew now, I suppose, you know, the average cyclist. But you know, our great antagonists traditionally were always black cab drivers, who are not uniformly awful, of course, but they do have a tendency. You know, the classic line is that there are two types of cab drivers: those with passengers and those without. And those without do tend to behave just as thoughtlessly, I suppose, as couriers do. So I got knocked off once by a courier, a cabbie pulling a U-turn in the middle of Oxford Street, and they do that often, just on a whim, seemingly, just to keep you on your toes. So they were. But what was very strange?
Were they very apologetic?
No, not really. No, not at all. Actually, no, they don't. It's part of the, I suppose, the confrontational game that you play. You can't acknowledge culpability, can you?
Well, so you're lying there spread-eagled on Oxford Street.
Yeah, I don't think it's that.
And they're not acknowledging that.
Well, they were just sort of, oh, we should have looked where you're going, mate, type idea. Yeah. I was once going down a bike lane in Bloomsbury, and the passenger of a cabbie opened his door on me, and the cabbie blamed me, and I thought that was extraordinary, and I just wouldn't let him leave. I just pulled up in front of him and called the police over and got him done, because you can't. I'm sure. I mean, maybe I don't know my Green Cross code well enough, but I'm sure they're supposed to pull over when they release their passengers onto the world. So he just thought, oh, he should have been able to stop on this door opening on you. But that's the risk: doors opening on you, cabbies doing U-turns,
and people lurching out, presumably.
People lurching out, but pedestrians. You can usually. I never hit a pedestrian, thankfully. I think cycling in London is very safe, and everyone should celebrate that and acknowledge that. But the thing that kills kind of 90% of cyclists in London is big lorries turning left onto you. Once you don't go anywhere near them and kind of avoid those kinds of scenarios, I think the most, you know, touch wood obviously, but the kinds of accidents you have are generally low-level scrapes and bumps.
From your POV, what's the commonest offence committed by people on two wheels?
Oh, no comment.
No comment.
No comment. I don't know.
I don't think we're allowing that.
Well, there's, you know, red light jumping, I suppose, is the thing that now I'm not a courier annoys me most about cyclists. But also,
is it really?
Yeah, I don't do it at all. But I did do it a lot.
I thought there was a big defensive argument for it.
There can be, I think, if you get to the front and there's no room for you because the car's parked in the ASL and you need to get out before the traffic starts moving again. But I'm not really talking about that kind of thing. I'm talking about the kind of flagrant bobbing through lights that serves to just annoy pedestrians. And I don't do that anymore, but I did do that. And I partly did that because, you know, you're getting paid by the job, so you really do need to get there as quickly as possible. Or at least that's what I told myself. But it also is because it was quite fun.
Yeah, I'm not going to dig any further. I wanted to ask you, though, we're putting together a show about the history of the cab trade. And in our sights at the moment, we have somebody who certainly was very senior in the worshipful company of that trade. Are there any questions or assertions you think it would be worth my while putting to this person?
I can't really. I don't want to. No, I mean, I can't think of anything.
Not just straight out abuse, is it?
No, quite. Yeah. I mean, it's always very attractive, and actually, lots of people I know. You know, the problem I think with couriering, and the reason I've got out of it, and many people have, is that eventually your body can't really do it anymore, and there's nothing worse than an old courier. And quite a lot.
How old are you?
I'm 32 now, but I think by the time you hit 40, things are beginning not to get easier on the bike. And so a lot of my colleagues and peers, and there's nowhere to go unless you become a controller, unless you go into the office and you're the person who's giving out the jobs, which is an art in itself and one you can only really develop by having been a courier, I think. Then the only kind of escape route is to become a cabbie. So a lot of people I knew on the road were doing the knowledge alongside couriering. So I'm sure, were I to voice any I mean, I'm sure they probably there's probably a few that have qualified now. But I always, I mean, have you read That Will Solve?
Before you go, if I'm reading between the lines correctly, you've got a vague idea you might need to fall back on becoming a cabbie at some point, and so you're not going to say anything too controversial.
I want to keep my options open, yeah. But it might be, I suppose I'd have to be an Uber driver, won't I, in the future when there are no cabbies. Maybe they're the
Well, now you've gone and done it. Do you think that's a probability?
I think it's a distinct possibility. I mean, there's already a sense in which the black cab is a kind of, a heritage treat that you give yourself. They're not the backbone of urban transport that they were even kind of 10 years ago, I don't get the feeling. You either get one because you haven't organised Uber on your phone, or you got a large, or because you want to take your kid in a pram, it seems, and you're allowed to do that in a cabin nowhere else. So I think the benefits of, I think it's going to become a kind of fairgroundy piece of heritage urban infrastructure, the cabbie and the knowledge. They're all easy sat nav now anyway, aren't they?
Well, I did notice the last time I hired a black cab, I jumped in and we were in a 30-mile-an-hour zone, and I'm certain that a self-imposed 20-mile-an-hour speed restriction was going on there.
Yeah, quite possibly. There's that wonderful Will Self novel, The Book of Dave, you must have read it, yeah, which captures something, I think, of the kind of absurd romanticism of the cabbie and that kind of ritualistic, guildish nature of it that makes it so attractive from the outside anyway. The idea of a future dystopian society based completely around the litany of the runs that you're due to recite in the knowledge is a kind of a lovely image and an idea, and again a way of kind of defamiliarising, I suppose, an urban and a particularly London kind of version of what it is to be urban. In the book I talk a lot about the relationship between kind of maps and the knowledge maps grant you of a place, and experiential knowledge. My big discovery as a courier was not just knowing the names of places, but kind of feeling the topography of the city in a way that I hadn't before. And I found over time that I was kind of discovering and unconsciously following the routes of all the subterranean rivers of the city, for instance, because a bike, like water, wants to flow downhill. So you're kind of in the mentality of liquids and gradations and topographies and so on. And in a way that, you're not, I don't think, even as a walker. A bike can expose the subtleties of an incline in a way that shoe leather can't. And I often found myself kind of following these different forms of ley lines, uncovering a kind of more, an older version of London, really, by bike.
Speaking of uncovering aspects of London, are there any places around town that might not have caught people's attention in terms of, particular views or places to just pause for a moment and get a different angle on the city?
Yeah, well, again, it's one of those things that you probably wouldn't realise why they're so attractive, but there are a few places that couriers gather, kind of little covens around the place, and usually you're like, well, why has that become a hotspot for couriers together? And one of the ones I remember most fondly is on Wood Street in the city. There's a row of ducts that spew kind of warm air from one of the big buildings there, and couriers gather there simply because it's warm in the winter. And it's a bit like, I've always felt like it was one of those, those kind of deep sea coral reefs that are cut off from the light that kind of exist around thermo vents at the bottom of the ocean. It was a bit like that life kind of discovers these places. Well, courier life discovers these places where there's kind of amenity, where the city offers you either because no one will move you on, or because, there's something off, either a toilet that you can use freely or hot air or free water or whatever. So those are the things you're looking for rather than the nice views. But the nice views come from, again, having access to this kind of backstage city. So the view from the top of Centre Point is phenomenal, and it's not an easy thing to just go and say, can I, get in your lift and have a look. But if you're sent on a wait and return to the embassy up there, you can make the most of it.
So I've got an idea that you see yourself as like a deep water fish or something.
Yeah, the metaphors were often oceanic, I think, yeah.
You talk incredibly well about cycling. That's very patronising to say, but you talk so... The reason I say you talk so well is because you've been talking now about the book and about this experience over and over again. Some people would be fed up with it by now. Yeah, I did that, what of it? I wondered, that aside, what would you... And I say that with in mind, the fact that you've been talking about this book now for some time. It's been out a little while.
Yeah, it's been out for a year now, yeah.
And
paperback's dropping soon.
Good.
Yeah.
And of course you'll be required then to talk even more about it. But I wondered if this weren't the subject that we were talking about, what would you like to spend 3/4 of an hour discussing?
In a London context?
No, not necessarily. Sitting in the park.
Sitting in the park context. Well, currently on my mind is just endless novels that I've been reading over the last 6 months. So I suppose it would be arguments about those and whether they're any good.
Can we mention the context?
Well, I mean, I've been judged for this year's Man Booker Prize, so that has been taken. I've read 160 books in the last 6 months, 160 novels, which works out as a book a day, and I now am free of that daily grind because we've announced our long list last month, but I'm still, you know, I'm rereading the long list and thinking about those books, all of which are excellent and you should seek out. Not many, like A.L. Kennedy's is a London novel. That's very kind of a modernistic, actually, take on the idea of a day in the life of a city.
But we can't go into too much detail at this point, can we? Because of
I can only say that they're all excellent and have an equal chance of winning, I think.
My final question, knowing people who are very physical for a living and seeing how their mood changes, how their demeanour changes, their creativity, if they don't get to move, what's the relationship for you between solid cycling and not solid cycling and the rest of your life? How do they affect each other?
It's a strong one, because I think when I stopped carrying, a lot of things in my life changed. I gave up because I was about to have a child, and then I did have a child, and so that was a big change. I also...
The ultimate delivery.
Yeah. And I also had to, you know, partly because I didn't see myself being a courier for the next decade and having a family, so I thought I had to find I won't say proper job, but a different job. So I did that, and I now teach English literature as an academic. And that was a big working change, I suppose. And I also moved house and various other things. So separating those different conditions from stopping cycling those kinds of distances is difficult to do. But I certainly think it's still the case that to have an idea and to work on an idea, the easiest way to achieve that is to go on a bike ride, or go for a walk at least, or get out and do something. You know, Wordsworth said famously that his brain only worked with his legs, and I feel that's completely the case with me and with most people.
Perfect place, I think, to come to rest, but not without mentioning the name of the book. And I mean, it's kind of redundant to say where it can be obtained. It can be obtained from the same bloody place that all books are obtained from. But what's it called?
It's called Cyclogeography: Journeys of a London Bicycle Courier. And it's published by Notting Hill Editions.
And the name on the spine is John Day. Thanks very much.
Pleasure, thanks for having me. My heart aches for some far off
place, no one could have left you. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to John Day. Thanks to Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm Ian Quentin Wolfe.
Sound you ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front door.